Last week we were in Numbers chapter 13, and there are a few people probably in churches and probably even many outside churches that have heard about the spies that the Israelites sent out. And that's what we talked about last week. God directed Moses to send out 12 spies into this promised land. There was one from each tribe. It included two people of note that will continue to be significant actors, significant participants in the stories as they unfold in the history here. Joshua, who was called Hoshea in the list, from the tribe of Ephraim, and Caleb from the tribe of Judah. And Moses gave them specific instructions. He said, start in the Negev, which is an area on the south end of the promised land, and then go into the hill country, spy out the land, the people, the cities, are they fortified, and gather some fruit if you can. And we know that the scriptures tell us this was the time of year that the first harvest of the grapes was ready. And so that puts us in summer, somewhere around summer to late July. And so the spies did just what Moses asked. They went to the Negev, and then they went to the very north portion of the land, and they really did a good job of gathering the data that Moses asked them to see what's there and to look at these specific things. How long were they in the promised land, do you remember?
40 days.
So they had some time. The people, I suppose, didn't expect them back in a day or two because they were going to be on foot, but that would be a bit of a wait to be at home waiting for the 12 to get back. It would be a noticeable time for them to be long gone. So when they got there, what did they find? What did they find in the promised land?
Strong people.
Well, they found strong people. That's true. Yeah, their very description was just what God had been saying. It's a land that flows with milk and honey. What other specifics can we talk about?
Fortified cities.
They found there were cities, and they were fortified, at least some or many. I don't know if it was all or not. What else?
Men of great size.
Yeah, well, the big people. Yep. What else?
Big grapes.
Big grapes. Yeah, they brought back one bunch of grapes, which was a little different than when you come home from the store with one bunch of grapes, right? It was one big bunch that they slung on a pole between two men to carry it. So it was of great size. They were specific about the people. They said that from the tribal folks that they saw descendants of Amalek, Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites, and Canaanites, and that specifically the Canaanites made their residence near the sea and along the river. They also said, we saw the descendants of Anak, and that's the big people. From other references that we went to, we saw that they were robust, they were tall, and so they took note of these people. And so they make their report, and they've talked about all of these things, and the majority just simply say, this isn't going to work. We're not going to be able to do this. Caleb made a response. What was Caleb's response? Do you remember?
Let's go and get in there.
Let's go. Let's go. Let's take possession. We will conquer. And we will own this land, which did quiet the people for a minute. And as is so often the case when people are trying to convince one another, the majority then speak back up and they start adding more information about why it can't be done. We saw the land. It devours its people. The Nephilim were there, which is the big people again. And we were grasshoppers in our sight. I think those words are so interesting. We saw ourselves as totally incapable, and they saw us that way too. When we looked back at Exodus 23, Should they have been surprised at finding these tribes in the Promised Land? Do you remember what we looked at in Exodus 23? Exodus 23 is where God told them they would find these tribes there, but that he himself would push those tribes back, push those people back, that he would send fear into their hearts ahead of them, fear of him, and that he wouldn't just throw them all out of the country at once, but he would do it incrementally at the right timing so that the land wouldn't become overgrown and being uncared for and being uninhabited. And so they should not have been surprised, but these people were sent out to be their experts, and their experts were coming back and saying, this can't be done. This doesn't make sense. We shouldn't even try. And we drew the parallel that many Christians defer to so-called experts today in the name of science and other kinds of thinking. And as a result, they find themselves not recognizing the truth of the scriptures, but find reason to doubt God, doubt the Bible, doubt the truth, doubt the plan of salvation you see in all of these things. It's so similar to the original sin. We talked about that when the snake appeared to Eve and caused her to question God's words, to see self as more knowledgeable than God and able to pass judgment on the truth of what God had told them, and to not trust God, which led to rebellion, disobedience, and being caught in Satan's trap. And that's what happens to many people who take the name of Christ today. They have modified what they believe and run from the truth of the scriptures in order to align themselves with folks that they think must know more than the folks that wrote down the very word of God through the inspiration of the Spirit. But that's the result of the spies. They come back and they convince the people that this isn't going to work, it can't be done, and it's a hopeless situation as far as their being the possessors of the Promised Land. With that said, let's turn over to chapter 14. That's where we're going to work through today as much as we, however time works out. You know, I often work some at trying to plan these times so that we get to a good stopping point and whatever. I have absolutely no idea where we'll wind up today. Will we get all of Numbers 14 done? Probably not. Will we hit a good stopping point? Well, I'm going to try, but we'll see how it goes. Let me start by reading verses 1 through 10 of chapter 14. So we're still there. We're still around the reporting time, and they've stopped the reporting, and this is the reaction that occurs. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept at that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land? To fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. So Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all of the sons of Israel. So how do the people react?
Rebellion and fear.
Rebellion and fear. Fear starts it all, right? Fear, and there's other emotions involved in here. What are they saying would have been better?
Die in Egypt.
Yeah, better off if we died in Egypt. What's their second best choice? Died in the wilderness. Now that's pretty despairing when you get to the point that the two things you can think of that would have been better than what they're faced with is to have died somewhere. It's just a matter of where. Who do they grumble to?
Moses and Aaron.
And it's at Moses and Aaron, as they're grumbling, that they direct these comments about dying in the wilderness or dying in Egypt. They ask Moses and Aaron a question. And what's their question? Well, that's what they said. What's their question?
Why does the Lord bring us?
Why did the Lord bring us here? Why did the Lord bring us here so that our wives and children would become plunder and that we would just be destroyed? What's the answer to that question? Why did the Lord bring them here?
Fulfill the promise of the prophecy.
And the promise and the prophecy was what? Who was it made to? Abraham. And the promise was the land. It's just a single verse, but let's go back to Exodus 23:20. This is part of what we read last time, but I think it's worth reading again. To just say it in one verse, this is why God brought you here. Now we're in Exodus 23:20. We are there, and God is... They're on the mountain. Words are being given to Moses. And the golden calf, I believe, has occurred. I might be off on that. But here's God's own words to Moses. Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and bring you into the place which I have prepared. So this isn't just God looking around the world and saying, well, where's a place I can put these people to make a nation? God has planned on this place and has actually prepared it for their use, for their inhabitants. And they are not thinking about that at all. And so here we are, we're going to die by the sword, and... what's their best answer? What's their best solution to the fact that they see themselves as weak and going to be run over militarily? Let's go back to Egypt. It'd be for the best. And what's the first step in their plan to go back to Egypt? Let's pick a leader. In other words, we're not going to look at Moses and Aaron. They're the ones that got us here. We're looking for a different horse. We're looking for a change here about who's going to lead us and take us back to Egypt. What kind of assumptions are they making when they say that we're going to go back to Egypt? Just think about it for a minute. What has to happen? What kind of things are they assuming would occur? What are they assuming will happen when they get to Egypt? Now, let's get this straight. When these folks are there last, what happened to the Egyptians?
All their firstborn died.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys were insisting on getting out of here. You were threatening us. Your threats came through Pharaoh. We had these plagues, and we reached a point where we think we're all going to die. So let's bring the people back that were going to make us all die. Oh, by the way, did you bring the plunder back with you? We'd like to have the candlesticks back, if you don't mind. I mean, can you imagine this? This is such a illogical idea that you could go back to the Egyptians and be received better than you would be received if you went on into the promised land and got killed there. As a matter of fact, how did Pharaoh respond to their absence after the firstborn had all died and they had plundered the land and taken off? What was his response to the Israelites?
Pursued them unto death.
Yeah, let's just go get them. We're going to kill these folks. Or bring them back and enslave them again or whatever. He was after them. And how did they escape that? Well, of course, we're all going to quickly remember God parted the Red Sea and got them on the other side. Oh, is that going to be a bit of a problem going back? Is God going to part the Red Sea in reverse direction for the people? No, so now they've got to plot a new path. And of course, it's just an easy journey between where they are in Egypt, right? What did they experience on the first trip coming from Egypt to through their journeys? Now they're up in the northern area up there. What did they experience along that trip?
Thirst.
Thirst, no water, no food. What else? Remember the battle with the Amalekites? They were confronted militarily on their trip, and it was by the power of God that they defeated the Amalekites. So let's get our stuff together and load up, and we're going to head out, and we're going back to Egypt. You really think you'll get there? Well, anyway, they planned on a new leader. Now, who picked their first leader for them? Who picked Moses?
God.
Absolutely, God did. God picked Moses and started that trip. What was the initiating event that God reacted to? I don't like the word reacted, because God knew this event was coming, but he let it be the trigger. You remember what the event was? The people were crying out in Egypt because of how they were being mistreated, and the scriptures tell us God heard them. And God even came to Moses at the burning bush and said, I've heard my people in their distress. And I'm appointing you to go lead them out of Egypt. Huh. Well, anyway, they're making some plans. And God picked the first leader. Now who's in charge as they think about picking a different leader? I don't mean what leader will they pick, but God picked the first leader. Who's going to pick this one? These people are. You know, in a sense, said very carefully, because there's a lot of nuances that don't fit. They'd make good Americans. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I'm going to figure it out, and by my own strength and determination, I'm going to get this done. Well, I don't want to throw too much disparaging kinds of comments on that attitude, because there are times and places for that. But this is definitely not one of them. So they've got quite a trip ahead of them, and they're going to pick another leader. How did Moses and Aaron react to all this? Fell on their faces in the presence of all the people. What's the significance of that? What does that mean? Well, I read some other passages, and there's a couple of things that stand out. This is a humble act. They are being humble. Now, who are they being humble toward? Because people do this act in humility toward God. Sometimes they do it in deference to people. And I think in one sense they're doing it for both. And I don't mean that they're trying to elevate the people, but I think it's in humility. It's not for themselves. I think this act is symbolic to the people that, please consider, don't worry about us, but consider what you're getting ready to do. This is not wise. I'm certain that they are pleading to God as well as the people in this humble act of throwing themselves down on their faces. They're not comfortable with it. I did find one example that I wanted to show us. And so go back to Genesis 17. We're going to read the first 8 verses. Genesis 17. And the verses themselves will set up the context. Genesis 17, 1 through 8. Now when Abram was 99 years old, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. Abraham fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you will be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings will come forth from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. I will give you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. To me, it's interesting that when God says he's going to establish the covenant between himself and Abraham and change his name to Abraham, Abram fell on his face. That's the right position in the presence of God for these kinds of things. And I think that carries over to what Moses and Aaron did. Now in verse 6, Joshua and Caleb have their own response. What do? They tore their clothes. What is the significance of that? Yes, grief. It's anguish. It's unhappiness. Distraught. And when they're tearing their clothes, they're just saying they're so distraught. They just have to do that. And they spoke to all the people. Now, I doubt that this was a quiet, gentle speech geared to affect the logical person in calmness. I imagine this speech was loud, it was clear, it was with energy, and what they said is, if the Lord is pleased with us, he will bring us to it and give it to us, this land of milk and honey. And I think they got it right. If the Lord is pleased with us, they cannot keep on rebelling against God himself and expecting that this is going to go okay with them. How many times has God been displeased with them and forgiven them and went on as though nothing had happened to an extent? Yes, there were ramifications, but in the end, it's still our trek to the promised land. And so they give an admonition, do not rebel against the Lord. Don't fear these people. They will fall before us. Their protection has been removed. The Lord is with us. Don't fear them. Anything but what they suggested in these three statements is rebellion. To fear these people is rebellion. Now, why would I say that? I might be asking you to make a connection that is too far toward the edge, but think about it for a minute. Why is their fear of these people rebellion?
Because they aren't taking the Lord into consideration and his promise.
They're not taking the Lord into consideration and his promise. And you can go back to the promise of giving them the promised land, but you can go to a very specific promise where he said, I will push these people back. He didn't say, I'm going to throw you in a war and I think you can make it. He said, this is what I'm going to do. And so he had Moses send them out to see what they were going to receive. But they went out and they looked at their own strength and forgot about God's. That's rebellion. They said, they will fall before us. And to believe anything else is an act of rebellion for the same reason. It's also a lack of faith. And then this statement to me is fascinating. Their protection has been removed. This says a lot about nations, doesn't it? Not just necessarily these tribes and these people in this place, but it says a lot about nations today. History is full of great nations falling when they appear to be still in their great days. And it's because God is no longer protecting them as a nation. Who establishes governments according to the Romans? God does. God does. Who changes governments? God does. God used very heathen governments from time to time to bring judgment upon Israel. Their protection has been removed. Well, these are great words. How did the Israelites react to this? What? I think we need to stone you, boys. You know, this is a typical reaction amongst mankind when people hear a truth they don't want to hear. If this had been clearly false, they should have been able to say, oh, go away. You guys don't even make sense. This isn't true. This is false. Go away. But they're disturbed enough by what these men say, they're ready to put them to death because they don't want to hear it and they don't have another way to negate the message other than to stone the men, to kill the men. Typical reaction when bearers of truth bring things to people they don't want to hear. What's the big event that happens next? They're going to stone him, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And that brings a stop to this mayhem of anguish and frustration and self-determination that is a contrary to what God had asked them to do. Questions, comments so far? Well, next we're going to turn over to verses 11 through 19. God's presence has been added to the mix. Let's see what happens. The Lord said to Moses, how long will these people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. But Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear of it, for by your strength you brought up these people from their midst, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of these people, for you, O Lord, are seen eye to eye, while your cloud stands over them, and you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, if you slay these people as one man, then the nations who have heard of your fame will say, because the Lord could not bring this people, into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness. But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you also have forgiven this people from Egypt, even until now. By the way, what happened to all these people and the things that they were doing and the stoning they were getting ready to do? What happened?
Well, if they're all of a sudden seeing the presence of the Lord, imagine they were kind of standing down a little bit.
I would guess so. Has the Lord demonstrated his power recently? When they asked for the meat, we had some people consumed by fire around the edges of the camp. And then we had the plague that came upon the people who were greedy and wanted the meat. Yeah, this God has not been fooling around lately, and he never did. He didn't put up with some of these things, and I imagine these folks had just enough common sense and recognition of the truth. This is God, and he's powerful, that they were trying to figure out what to not do in order to get crosswise with God. They had one fallacy that shows up right here in their concept of God. And that fallacy was that if I don't see God right now, then he doesn't see what I'm doing. Because they had done all these things just like God didn't exist. Now that they see him, they're, oh, stop. And in reality, God was seeing this all the way through. And it shows up in what he does with Moses. So the Lord says to Moses, how long will they spurn me? It's a question, right? And he asked Moses, what answer does God expect from Moses? Does Moses have the answer to that question? No. This is a rhetorical question. Basically, God says, I can't believe they're still spurning me, although God knew men and he did know they would do that. How long, he says, will they not believe in me despite all of the signs that I've done? When God says, how long will they spurn me? How long will it be before they believe in me? What does he mean by believe in me? Do the people believe that God exists? Yeah, they've been watching a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. They were so afraid of him on the mountain, they wanted Moses to do all the interaction with him. So what does it mean when God says, implies by the question, they don't believe in me.
They don't trust or rely on
him. They don't trust him. They don't believe him. They don't hear what he says as though it's said by the almighty, powerful Jehovah. And so Jehovah says, how long are they going to spurn me? When will they believe in me? God goes on in verse 12 to say, I'll smite them. I'm going to bring pestilence, disease, maladies, plagues. I'll dispossess them. They're no longer going to be my people. Moses, I'll make you a great nation, greater and mightier than they. I don't want to be too frivolous about this, but Moses doesn't react to this, does he? Well, he reacts to it, but he doesn't say, all right, I'll be a great people. Does he embrace that idea? No. How high was this bar that God set? How much greater? I mean, you'd have to be a lot greater than these people to truly be a great people, wouldn't you? These people have set such a low bar for what it means to be a people that God possesses, to be a people that believe in God, that trust God, that have faith in God. They have been terrible performers. They have set an extremely low bar. The only thing that God has been able to depend on out of these people is more than 48 hours, we're going to have another rebellion. And usually it's before 48 hours. And so here he has shown them the greatest land, this wonderful land that he'd shown to their forefathers, in particular Abraham, and gave it to him, and they are abandoning God. Now, Moses does respond to what God says about turning these people away, dispossessing them, not being God's people anymore, putting them to a death, essentially. And Moses says, no, after you do this, the Egyptians are going to hear about this. You've already shown them your strength as you liberated these Israelites. And they're going to talk this up. You know that God that beat us up so bad? Well, he couldn't handle those folks very well either. That's essentially what Moses says. You are known to the people. They've seen you eye to eye. You have presented yourself as a physical presence, the cloud and the fire. And so you made your presence known. And if you slay these people, the nations that have heard of you will say that you could not bring the people into the land. And as a result, you let go of your promise. You let go of what you swore by your oath and slaughtered them in the wilderness. This is how you'll be known as a promise keeper. One who tries, but when it doesn't work and the people don't cooperate, you let the promise go and bring death to them. Now, just before this encounter with Jehovah, how had the people treated Moses? Right before this interaction between Moses and God, how had the Israelites treated Moses?
They dispossessed him as their leader.
Yeah, but they turned him back. We're done with you. Well, they probably were included in the stoning, but for sure it was Joshua and Caleb that were going to be stoned, and probably Moses and Aaron as well, I would guess. Why is Moses sticking up for them? That's an interesting question. And do you remember what God said to Moses when they demanded meat? How did God react to their demand for meat when, I'm sorry, how did Moses react to God when the people demanded the meat? You remember? I should have written those verses down. God heard Moses say, "These people wear me out." Not exactly what he said, but they constantly want, how am I going to provide meat for them? And God says, "Well, you go tell them there'll be meat. Not only meat, but you're going to have a whole month of meat." Moses goes, what are you going to have me do? Kill all the fish of the sea or slaughter all of the flocks? And God says, "Oh, you're going to see my power." And certainly God did that. But Moses wasn't real happy with these people just a while back when they were demanding meat. But now he's sticking up for them despite the fact that they're still just as difficult, despite the fact they've rejected his leadership and Aaron's leadership. But really, when we read what Moses says, he really is sticking up for God more than Moses. But we could see where Moses might say, "You know what? Getting these people out of, you gave me a job I didn't want. Go clear back to the burning bush. I told you, God, I didn't want this job." He made it clear recently, "I'm not having fun in this job. This is a terrible job." God says, "I'm going to relieve you of this job. I'm going to make you a great people." And he says, "God, don't do that." So Moses makes his objection about what that will mean about God's testimony. And then he makes a plea to God. "Now I pray, let the power of Jehovah be great. Just like you proclaimed, the Lord is slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression." He goes on to say, Moses, "He will not clear the guilty. You let the iniquity of the fathers go down to the children, to the fourth and generation. So pardon, I pray, the iniquity of these people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just like you've been doing from Egypt until now." And we need to look at this, what Moses says here, very closely. Because Moses is looking at God and saying, starts with verse 17, "Now I pray to you, let your power be great. Do what you said when you said that you are slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, and forgiving iniquity and transgression." Not clearing guilty folks, but letting the iniquity of the fathers go to the children, to the third and fourth generation. Where does all of that come from? Go back to Exodus 34. Now, this is after the golden calf. And Moses has been pleading with God to still stay with the people, to still take them to the promised land, essentially to forgive them and keep the covenant and keep it all going much as it has been. And God says this about that, reacting to that, and describes himself in this way. And why do I not? 33, there's 34. 6 and 7. Then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed. This is God proclaiming about himself. The Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. Moses goes back to what God himself said about himself after the golden calf and says, you are powerful, stay powerful, and continue to be consistent in your reactions, living out who you are. And he reminds God of what he heard. And so if we go back and think about those words a little bit, Moses is saying to God, you proclaimed yourself slow to anger, so be slow to anger here. You said you are filled with loving kindness, that it's abundant in you, so show your loving kindness, please. You forgive iniquity and transgression, not so the guilty are not known or not taken, not held accountable, but you let the iniquity of the fathers go to the children to the third and fourth generations. And we talked about this, and I'm sure we need to revisit it a bit. We're not saying here that the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are guilty in the eyes of God for punishment because of what a previous ancestor did, but the effects of these things. When these people rebel, there are consequences. It permeates their society. It changes their own understanding of God and their own behaviors, their own attitudes. And God says that effect of that sin is going to continue, and it will affect their futures. And then he says, so do just like you've been doing from Egypt until now. God, this isn't the time to change how you respond to the people. This is the time to stay consistent, to maintain your greatness and your testimony in front of the whole world. Everybody in the world, I'm probably not saying that well, but everybody in the whole world has become aware of what you're doing with these people. You defeated the most powerful nation in the world. You plundered them with these people. The world is watching. What are you doing? Where are these people going to go? What's going to become of them? And so stay consistent. Now there is, in Moses' request, a phrase we need to look at. And that is when he says to God, pardon, I pray, the iniquity of these people according to the greatness of your loving kindness. He didn't say according to their response, according to anything except how great your loving kindness is. In other words, let that be the measure of your loving kindness. Let that be the measure that you use to decide how to respond to these people. How great is your loving kindness, God? He didn't ask the question. He didn't need to ask the question. He knew the greatness of God's loving kindness. And he's saying, show the depth of your loving kindness now. Do it according to the greatness of your loving kindness. And so that's Moses' plea to God. Stay on the path. And so we get God's response then beginning in verse 20. But before I read on, questions, comments, thoughts?
I had a question for you. So whenever I read passages like this, I have do you view as a scholar, like a Bible scholar, when you're reading this passage, the promise that God proposes to Moses to make of him a great nation as something that's actually possible? Or do you believe that God is, in this moment, allowing Moses to fulfill or to create a type that is then fulfilled in the person of Jesus Christ?
Well, I have to start with the way you asked the question. I'm more of a Bible stumbler than a scholar, okay? I stumble around looking for answers to those kinds of questions. I certainly fully, wholly, completely believe in the sovereignty of God. I am certain when God asked Moses to do that or to consider that, that God knew that it wasn't going to happen. There's no doubt in my mind that he knew that. But God has done something very interesting with Moses. I'm glad you asked the question. I'm not sure where I was going to say this, and I'd have probably forgot as a result, and now I won't. God has put Moses in an extremely unique position with regard both to God himself and the people. Because Moses is all about the testimony of God in the world. He's looking at what's going on and saying, you need to show your greatness. That's just the purpose here. You're glorifying yourself in how you react to and handle these people. And even using the word react to, I think, is wrong if you talk about the sovereignty of God. But your displayed response to these people, maybe you would say it that way. And at the same time, Moses, who is nothing but frustrated with these people most of the time, is over there taking up their case with energy and logic before God, to the point that in other situations he said, if you take them out, you got to take me too. And to me, that's just an amazing place that God has led Moses to through the things that he said to Moses and the things that he's done with Moses and with the people. Because God is frustrated with these people. There's no question they've offended God. There's no question they've offended Moses. There's no question that God has even made a great case for justice would be, there, now, throw that dead fly away, let's look for a better one. That would have been justice all the way through this trip from Egypt. And yet, that isn't God's plan, that isn't what he did. We know that he is steadfast, he's going to fulfill his promise to Abraham, but he does it in a way that shows the depth of Moses' conviction, and God even does these things in a manner that strengthens Moses' conviction, both to want to see God glorified and to see God's mercy take these people to the fulfillment of the promise. That's just pretty amazing. And I think that's God's sovereignty at work. I think that was his intent, and probably many other things that I don't have the insight to pick up on, but I think that's the kind of thing that's happening here. Could God have written all of the first five books of the Bible before it happened? Yeah. Because he knew exactly what was coming. He knew exactly what the people would do. He knew exactly how frustrating they would be. And yet he responded to their cry and brought them out of Egypt and fulfilled his promise to Abraham by so doing. Good question. And you triggered something I probably would have forgotten. Any other questions or comments? Well, here's the awkwardness of where we are. This next passage is long, and we're not even going to get a good start into it. So let me see if I can wrong spot. Let's read down through 25, and we'll see if I can make that a stopping point after verse 25. Beginning in verse 20. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit, has followed me fully. I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. So let's look at these few verses. It's interesting to me that it seems, now, we don't have a timeline for this conversation between Moses and God, but it just seems to me it happens quickly, that God is waiting on Moses to say the things that Moses needs to say so he can say, oh, I've pardoned them according to your word. God, there's no hesitation. God doesn't voice any secondary thoughts. He just says, yes, I've done that. But it's not the kind of pardon that will leave everybody thrilled with it. Matter of fact, it's not going to leave very many people thrilled with it, even though they should be exceedingly thrilled if they stopped and looked at the alternatives of what God's judgment could bring. God says, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. So God is going to go forth from here, and he's going to glorify himself by the way he leads these people into the promised land, what happens in the promised land, and what happens between where they are now and going into the promised land. And he talks about the going in more later. But surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not listened to my means, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers. In other words, what we're going to hear as we develop the passage is the ones that came out as adults and have seen all of the things that I have done, they're not going to be in the promised land. And we'll get more details about that later. But he says, the ones who put me to the test these 10 times. In other words, God says, there are 10 times that the people tested me. They failed to trust me. They put me in a position where I had to show them my power. And so this dividing up that's happening in here with these people reminds me so much of what we see in Romans. Let's turn over to that very quickly. Romans chapter 9. And I think the passage in Romans is aimed at a little bit different situation, but I think it illustrates what's going to happen right here. Because Paul is talking about his sorrow for his own people. But he makes a definition here to find something that I think is valuable. Beginning in verse 6, Romans 9, verse 6 through 12. It is not as though the word of God has failed. Talking about the promises to Israel. For they are not all Israel who are descended from Israel. They're not all the people of Israel just because they came from Jacob's heritage. Nor are they all children because they are Abraham's descendants. But through Isaac your descendants will be named. So he brings a division that occurred, that Abraham had offspring. Isaac was one, Ishmael the other, but it's only Isaac is the child of the promise. So there's one division. And that is, it is not the children of the flesh, in verse 8, who are children of God, but the children of the promise are regarded as descendants. And I skip verse 7. No, I didn't. For this is the word of promise. At this time I will come, and Sarah shall have a son. That's still the first division. And not only this, But there was Rebekah also, and she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac, even though the twins were not yet born, had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. It was said to her, the older will serve the younger, just as it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. And then you could go on, and it's a great teaching that comes up about how the sovereignty of God is just and correct in doing these kinds of things. But God is going to divide up the land. The promise is not going to be fully extended to these adults that had every opportunity to see God's power and might at work. But instead, there were 10 times that they put him to the test. So I wanted to make a list of the 10 times. I got some help. The best help came from the MacArthur Study Bible. He's got a list of 10 items in there. And he starts out with the Red Sea because the people tested God. They were upset. God brought us out here to be killed by the Egyptians. No. And he parts the sea. They get on the other side of the Red Sea and they don't have water. Okay, God brought, he brought us through the sea. Now he's going to make us die of thirst. No. God provided the water. Oh, we don't have anything to eat. God provided the manna. And then in the gathering of manna, that God gave them instructions, and they didn't do it right, so some had their manna fail, because they just wouldn't do what God said. And then some tried to gather on the Sabbath, despite the fact God had given a double dose of manna on the day six, and people had to follow that. Once again, they run out of water, and they get water from the rock. That's over in Exodus 17. And then in the golden calf, they actually turn to another god. And God forgives them, despite they put him to the test. And then we recently saw the complainers and how God judged some of them with fire. And then we have the quail, and the greedy ones get judged with plagues. And then here we are. This is number 10. Numbers 14, they come to the promised land, and God has told them how he's going to do it even, and they say, it's not possible, it won't work. And so those are John MacArthur's good list, and I don't have a better one, so I'm going to go with that one as we talk about this. And he does say, though, Caleb supported me. He's going to go in and be a part of it, and he has a different spirit, followed me fully, and so I'm going to bring him, and his descendants shall take possession of it. And then he says, you know, there's Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. You're going to set out for the wilderness by way of the Red Sea tomorrow, and God's going to start leading them in their time between now and the entry to the promised land, and the adventures are far from over. So next time we'll pick it up with Numbers 14:26. Thank you. I've stolen a couple. Anybody want to make any parting comments or questions? All right. I'll see you next time.